From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! As politics heats up in this election year, the arts become a favorite target. We'll look at art censorship and the culture wars. Then part two of our discussion on the controversy over slavery in the Sudan. And a look at the prison industrial complex.
We've simply moved from the pyramids to the plantation to the projects to the prisons. That has been the sojourn of African people.
Former prisoner Eddie Ellis recommends a 5-year moratorium on prison construction. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! And welcome to Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, if it's Tuesday, it is Right Wing Watch, and today we take a look at art censorship. Censorship of the arts is alive and well in the United States. The latest report from People for the American Way documents 137 challenges to artistic expression in 41 states in both traditional arts and the media. Many of these challenges have been attempts by religious and social conservatives to keep artistic references to homosexuality from reaching the general public. The report documents that almost 3/4 of the challenges were successful in having the artwork removed or restricted in some way. Joining us to talk about this issue is Anne Green, coordinator of Art Save, which is a project of the People for the American Way, and Donald Lipsky, who is a sculptor whose controversial work using American flags was desecrated and eventually removed on the Long Island campus of CW Post. And we welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's begin with Anne Green. Can you tell us about this report on the last year around art censorship?
Good morning, Amy. Yes, the report illustrates that there is diminishing respect for freedom of speech that is really at the heart of our society. While the religious right-wing political organizations began the culture war and used censorship as a tool, we see that they've really shaped the way Americans or Americans' attitudes towards freedom of expression. This year, more than ever, we've seen mainstream politicians begin to use the tactics begun by these political organizations, challenging material that they find objectionable, because they've recognized that there is a political harvest to be reaped by indulging in some of this, at least some of the measure of the rhetoric of these organizations.
Tell us about some of the tactics that these art critics use to go after art.
What we see a lot of times is one or two people being very vocal about challenging a piece of work that they find objectionable. And as a result, they are vocal enough to get the piece taken down or removed. No one has time to react or to bring in the rest of the community to decide what should be done.
Let's go. Why don't we go to one example, and that is Donald Lipsky, who is a sculptor out in Long Island, New York. Donald, are you there?
Yes, hi, Amy.
Hi. Why don't you tell us about your piece of work, who it was funded by, where it was shown, and what happened?
The sculpture in question is called American Flag Ball Number 3. It's an 8-foot in diameter ball that appears to be made of American flags wound up like a ball of string. The flags were actually hundreds of yards of flag material from a flag company in Philadelphia that were meant to be cut up and made into flags. The show in its entirety was sponsored by the Fabric Workshop in Philadelphia, which works with artists to realize fabric projects, and was shown at the Corcoran Gallery in Washington and other places.
And what were you trying to say with this piece of work?
Well, I made this in the late in 89 and 90. I made a series of works with the American flag that my only point was to just claim that the government should not make flags off limits to artists. I use all sorts of things in making my art. And the idea that this one object should be off limits to me seemed un-American. What happened recently was in December, a U.S. congressman named Peter King from Suffolk County, and a group of veterans held a protest at CW Post College in Long Island, where my work had been sitting innocuously since 1991. They demanded that the university remove the work, and the university, to its credit, defended it and said they had no intention of removing the work. However, a couple weeks after this congressman's demonstration, a vandal went out with a knife and slashed the piece apart and basically destroyed it, which to me was had great irony, thinking of someone who thought that I was desecrating the flag out there with a knife slashing away at this sculpture.
I thought it was very interesting the way the Village Voice put it in their piece about what happened called Capture the Flag, where they said clearly this person or persons who felt that they had to remove it felt they had to destroy the flag in order to save it.
Yeah. Well, that's the sort of poetry we're used to from Elizabeth Hess.
Now, there was a Congress member who got involved with this.
Other than Peter King?
Well, Peter King, and were there other Congress members who got involved?
Not that I'm aware of.
So what are you doing now? Are you going to recreate this piece? Are you part of a political movement to defend art?
No. Well, certainly any political movement to defend art can count me as a member. I'm giving a talk next week, I believe the 15th, in the middle of the day at CW Post. And I don't have any intention to recreate the work, although I understand there is a movement afoot on the campus driven by the students to try to get the university to ask me to do that, which I don't know if I'll do that or not. I'll tell you, thinking back over the life of this flag desecration business, which I don't like the idea of desecration as a word, because it implies that the flag is sacred, and I don't think that anything should be off limits to artists. When I was younger, I remember Abby Hoffman getting arrested for wearing a flag shirt, and I remember him being on Johnny Carson and his body being blocked off from the neck down, as if it was going to be just too offensive for people to possibly see this man wearing an American flag shirt. And you contrast that with today, where you have such things as Pat Buchanan wearing an American flag hat, and he probably doesn't realize that he is the beneficiary of the groundwork laid by Abby Hoffman.
You know, I don't know why I make this association, but last night I was watching the news on TV, and they were doing a piece on what's going on in Atlanta right now, because they have trademarked the Olympics name, and there was a body shop called the Olympics. In fact, the guy is an artist. He runs an orchestra, and he funds it by running this body shop. And they made him change the name of his body shop, saying he couldn't use the word Olympics, and he has since lost half of his customers. And there was a woman who's making all sorts of T-shirts for the Olympics, and she used the word in on her T-shirt, Atlanta. And
right.
She has now been sued by the committee and by those in Atlanta for using the word Atlanta.
Amy, I think the driving force behind this, you know, of course there's been the Special Olympics for years, which is for retarded or handicapped children. And a group decided to have gay Olympics. And that's when the Olympic Committee came down and said you cannot use the word Olympics. So maybe in order to justify that, they've had to come down on the Olympic pizza parlor or whatever it is.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Donald Lipsky, for joining us. I know you're racing for a plane.
Exactly.
Donald Lipsky is a sculptor whose controversial work using an American flag was desecrated and eventually removed from the CW Post campus on Long Island, although the president of the campus did defend it. And we're still joined by Anne Green, coordinator of ArtSave Project of People for the American Way. Anne, tell us about some other examples like Donald's, and if there are any success stories where communities rallied round.
Well, a parallel example that is happening now in Tucson, Arizona, there is an exhibit called Old Glory, which has many works that illustrate the flag. The American Legion down there challenged the exhibit, and plenty of politicians joined in. Newt Gingrich said he wanted the exhibit taken down. Senator McCain made a statement from Arizona. And I just want to say that this kind of rhetoric that is becoming part of the political climate is making it a very hostile climate for artists and has really created a chill on expression, a chilling effect. Although the report can't record all the types of or the chill that is happening, because if the artist doesn't feel like they can create a work, then we can't record any sort of challenge. We do see trends that show the chill effect that is that this type of climate is having. This year, the sponsors of artwork have been challengers, and that has really risen from last year, 10%, from 8 to 18% this year, and it really shows the chilling effect of this hostile climate.
What about art funding in general with the NEA? We thought that for a while there, the National Endowment of the Arts was no longer going to be with us. Do you think that that is still a threat?
I think that we are going to see an election year. It could become an election issue. Last year, you saw the National Endowment for the Arts cut by 40%. The freshmen who were newly elected said they were out for blood and wanted to get rid of the agency. At the same time, you saw a lot of people who in the past had not spoken up create a grassroots movement in support of not only the NEA, NEH, and NEH, but also public broadcasting. People thought that that was an easy victim. But as soon as the American public found out that it was going to be cut, have such devastating cuts, there was a real grassroots movement. No one wanted to see it done. And a lot of senators and congressmen started backpedaling.
You know, the culture wars have a lot to do with sexuality and suppression of sexuality and also issues of religion. You write in your report, Anne, that art is often a scapegoat for public apprehension about the moral condition of American society and the fear of a perceived erosion of moral values. Can you talk about some of this art controversy around sexuality and religion?
It is always there. I can give some examples. The art has always been a scapegoat for this type of people believe about the moral condition of America. And this also was begun by the religious right. An example is in Clearwater, Florida. The Christian Coalition petitioned the production of Angels in America, which is Tony Kushner's nationally acclaimed play. The city commission, as a result, passed a resolution. The theater receives public funding, and they stated that the theater receives public funding and then asked the theater to be more sensitive and aware of the community standards before booking performances. So you see a lot of people just scared of anything the artist wants to communicate. The artist basically is trying to bridge a lot of different communities, and people are scared of that.
What about issues of homosexuality in art?
That is always a big issue. 35% of the incidents that we recorded this year contained homosexual content. That includes what I had just said in Clearwater, Florida, with Angels in America. Actually, there was recently an incident with Angels in America again in Charlotte, North Carolina. But we also see a lot of this in the public schools and public libraries when one parent can come into a library or a school and is very worried about there's going to be a promotion of homosexuality. An example is in Arizona. A parent requested the removal of Maurice, the movie that it was adapted from E.M. Forrester's book. Morris is actually how it's pronounced, which is a book about teenagers in high school in England. And I think one of the students is a homosexual. And that was she requested that it be taken off the shelves because she believed that it promoted homosexuality. Luckily, the library went through a formalized process and decided to retain the book. We also see this attacks on pop culture with the religious right organizations. There were plenty of campaigns against such films as Priest, where there was a homosexual priest involved. They will continue these kind of tactics.
How successful are boycott campaigns against sponsors of programs, say on television, that people don't like? And who is engaging in these boycott campaigns?
The primary suspect is Don Wildman from the American Family Association. He sends out a Fight Back book to his members, which basically lists sponsors to all types of TV shows that a lot of people watch and are very popular, such as Friends, ER, Sybil, Seinfeld. These are only a few of the shows, but they are a vocal and loud vocal minority. They have not been taking many shows off the air because of Don Wildman, except maybe in Alabama. But, you know, it does have an effect when a producer comes to produce something again. They might try not to upset this constituency.
What about censorship on the left? Is that an issue that you have documented?
We always try to document the censorship on the left, and we do believe that challenges can originate from either sides. But as far as organized challenges from right-wing or left-wing organizations, right-wing really wins at 21%, and we did not find any left-wing organized challenges. We do find them with individuals, and I can give you some examples. Eyes on the Prize was actually challenged in Dorchester, Massachusetts, as being as promoting racism and being too confusing. It was challenged by a teacher. A librarian had shown segments of Eyes on the Prize and it had actually discussion group with the class. Another teacher found that she thought there wasn't enough discussion surrounding the work and believed that it was promoting racism. As a result, the principal prohibited all use of films by the library. And it is still an issue in Dorchester.
Let me ask you, we only have a minute or so to go, but about maybe the most significant issue there, because it's one that can't be documented, and that is the issue of self-censorship as a result of overt censorship and fear of censorship. How do you document that?
As I said before, we can look at when a sponsor of artwork, such as a gallery or museum, becomes a challenger because they believe that the work may be potentially offensive. We also documented at the local level when art is attacked as a way of attacking public arts funding. We see arts organizations and arts councils rejecting certain artworks because they fear they're going to be cut, and with good reason if you look at what happened with the National Endowment.
Well, then let me ask this as we wrap up. How is People for the American Way organizing? I mean, the Christian Coalition has actually been around for less time than People for the American Way. You've been documenting these kinds of issues for a long time, yet the Christian Coalition is much more successful, it seems, at organizing.
We truly believe that, especially using this type of report as an education tool for the public, that people will become aware and remember to value free expression. And we hope that as the right becomes, you know, they've become strong and they've actually really shaped the way Americans believe about freedom of expression. And we hope that we can turn that around.
If people want to get a hold of your report, how can they?
They can give us a call at 202-467-4999.
One more time.
202-467-4999. And I will also say that there is an activist kit at the end of the report that helps people to create their own coalitions in support of freedom of expression.
Anne Green, we want to thank you very much for joining us. Anne Green is coordinator of the ArtSave Project of People for the American Way. Up next, the discussion of controversy around slavery in the Sudan, and then a very provocative speech by a former prisoner named Eddie Ellis. You're listening to Democracy Now! Listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's national daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman. As I said earlier, we'll be hearing from Eddie Ellis, who has a very provocative idea about how prisons should be dealt with in just a little while. But right now, we're going to go to an issue that we began to deal with last week. And those of you who heard us trying to discuss the controversy over slavery in the Sudan know that you probably didn't get too much information and can appreciate the amount of heat that has been generated, particularly in the African-American community, about this issue. We had on one of the heads of the Nation of Islam, the Africa representative of the Nation of Islam, and we also had on the head of an anti-chattel slavery group here in the United States. But the anger was so intense, it was hard to get to the facts. And so we thought we'd give it a try again. I'm joined by Salim Wakil, my co-host in Chicago. Salim, are you there? Well, we will attempt to bring him in through the conversation, but I'm also joined in the studio by Jamira Roan, and she is counsel at Human Rights Watch. She visited Sudan last year and met with several children who escaped slavery. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Well, why don't we start at the beginning? First of all, because so many people have trouble with geography, where the Sudan is in Africa.
The Sudan is the largest country in Africa in land mass. It's directly to the south of Egypt and on the Red Sea.
And when did you go there?
I was there in May and June of last year in the north, in the government-controlled areas. I visited the capital, Khartoum. I had previously made two visits to the south, to rebel-controlled areas, in 1993 and earlier in 1995.
And what did you find?
Well, I found one of the worst human rights pictures in the world, speaking in global terms about Sudan, between the effects of the war on the civilian population and the repression, the political repression that's going on in the north. All sides to the conflict have a great deal of blame. I looked at slavery in the context of looking at what was going on in the north in general, not thinking that I would find too much because, as I said, there is a great deal of political repression and it's people are not able to form human rights organizations or speak out freely or publish freely about human rights abuses in the north. So I did not know that I'd be able to locate any actual witnesses or victims. But I was fortunate in finding some through a sort of underground group of activists.
And who were the people that you found?
Well, I found several children who I talked to individually at great length and got their stories, which we published in a report that was issued on children in Sudan in September 1995. Their testimonies are published in rather full detail.
Why don't you tell us their stories?
Well, I'll try to summarize some of the highlights. The girl that I talked to had been raided from her village in 1986 or 87. This is in an area that's between north and south. To the north, there are Arab tribal militias, and she is a Dinka, the largest southern black African tribe in Sudan that lives on this border region with the Arab tribes. The Arab tribal militias had been armed by the government as a way of carrying on a a counterinsurgency war against the rebel forces. The government's theory was that the rebel forces were supported by the Dinka civilian population. This rebel group, the Sudan People's Liberation Army, the leadership is Dinka. At the time, it was composed of all different peoples in the south, but the government decided that it would be an effective counterinsurgency strategy to strike at the civilian population and the support base of the SPLA, which is not unusual. This is the same counterinsurgency strategy that we human rights investigators find in country after country, where the civilians are victimized by one of the sides that believes that they support the other. The arming of the Arab tribal militias really tipped the balance in this area in favor of the Arab tribal militias, and they were able to plunder, raid, loot cattle, take grain, burn, kill anybody who got in their way, and take women and children slaves, which they did. And this practice continued after the current government came to power in 1989 through a military coup. They regularized the situation somewhat, incorporated these tribal militias into people's popular defense forces, and now they're part, under the umbrella of the army. And they and the army continue to conduct raids in this area and also in other areas following this same pattern.
Let's see if we can get Salim Wakil up in Chicago. Salim, are you there?
I'm here, Amy.
Good to hear
you.
Morning. We are talking with Jamira Roan, who is counsel at Human Rights Watch, and she visited Sudan in 1995, met with several children who had escaped slavery. Salim, when we talked last week, you had brought up the issue of slavery in the Sudan as something you were following. How did you first get interested in it?
Well, I first really got interested in it during a trip to Africa myself in the mid '70s, but there were rumors about this institution of slavery that had been instituted by Arab conquerors in days past that there were vestiges of lingering in the Sudan and in other countries particularly in Eastern Africa. But there seemed to be fewer and fewer incidents of it, and the information about the institution seemed to be that it was on the wane, and except in a few countries, and Mauritania was one of those countries, Mali, those countries in more toward the western part of Africa and a little bit more north were also rumored to have that, vestiges of slavery still going on. So I had been following it kind of, in an offhand kind of way, not really devoting too much attention to it. And then it was Nate Clay himself who visited Libya in the mid-'80s and came back, well, late-'80s, I think 89. And when he came back, he told me about an incident he related to us last week on the show about meeting in a Bedouin camp, meeting a black African who said he was brother slave.
That's right, and they referred to him as brother slave.
They referred to him as brother slave. And so I became a little bit more interested, and I've been following it ever since. And then, I've been on the outskirts of the investigation for quite a while.
Why do you think it generates such tremendous hostility in the African-American community, particularly you have someone like Nate Clay, who we had on, head of the Anti-Chattel Slavery Coalition, and someone like Akbar Muhammad, who is the Africa representative of the Nation of Islam. The Nation of Islam is now championing countries like the Sudan and saying that slavery doesn't exist there. Why the tremendous heat?
Well, in some ways, I'm a little bit perplexed by it, because for many years the Nation of Islam has condemned the so-called Arabization of Islam itself, and so it seemed to me it would be a perfect issue for the nation to make a distinction between Arab cultural imperialism and a kind of Islamic practice that has been identified with it. It would seem to me that they would want to make that distinction. But I think in this particular case, Akbar has commercial links to the Sudan and to Ghana. He has a travel agency, and he's really the most outspoken opponent of this anti-slavery group. But also, the Nation of Islam is newly considered part of the fold. In the past, the nation has been considered kind of a heretical group because of its differing Islamic perspective. But since the Million Man March and Farrakhan's credibility has been enhanced through that, I think other countries are beginning to see him truly as a leader in the black community, and it's given him a new sort of credibility. And with that credibility, he can actually get what is called dawah funds or charity funds from other Islamic countries, and he may not want to poison the well, so to speak, by bringing up these uncomfortable issues of slavery. That may be the motive behind it, but I think primarily what it is more of a response, a kind of a reaction to these charges against Islam that many of the opponents are making. And unfortunately, I think that I see the beginning of a kind of acrimonious debate that is a tradition in the black community, especially in the black nationalist community, between nationalists influenced by Islam and nationalists who have a completely different idea of what Islam has done to the African-American community.
Let me ask Jamira Roan, a counsel at Human Rights Watch, how this controversy that is gaining a lot of attention in the African-American press, in fact, in the mainstream press, in the Washington Post just a couple weeks ago, there was a big piece because there were hearings on slavery in the Sudan. How does that affect your research?
Well, it makes people more interested in the subject. And from a human rights point of view, we don't care if they come to the subject with a good motivation or a bad motivation, as long as they begin to look at the victims and see the terrible cost that the women and children who've been taken into slavery have to pay. We're very grateful. So despite the fact that it's controversial, this is not the first controversial item that's ever been on the human rights agenda. We're used to controversy. Let me just say that this also was controversial in Khartoum. In 1987, a report was written by two northern Sudanese intellectuals who are from the northern community, who are consider themselves Arabs and are Muslims and so on and so forth, at the University of Khartoum. They were human rights activists who were concerned about this, and they did a report on a massacre of about 1,000 Dinka by some of the tribal militias. And with that report, they also published an evaluation of the resurgence of slavery in Sudan due directly to the war. And they were the ones that brought this problem to public attention in Sudan and therefore in the world first in the current debate first started with them in 1987. They published a report in Arabic. They published a summary of it in English at the same time in 1987. And it was hotly debated, and they were attacked by people within Sudan who did not want to believe that these things were still happening. They got a great deal of support from the southern community, as you can imagine, the victims and their relatives. And a newspaper published in Khartoum by a southerner called Sudan Times began to carry stories also of children and men and women who had escaped from slavery, with the details of everything that had happened to them and how they had been beaten and forced to work against their will and not given adequate food or shelter or anything like that, and taken from one place to another against their will. The newspaper and these human rights activists were attacked, and not physically attacked, but one of the authors was put in jail a couple of times under the prior government. Under the current government, as soon as they came
into Bashir,
yes, the same government. When they took power in 1989, they put this one of the two authors in jail for 22 months, during which time they did the same thing as the prior government did. They went to him and they asked him to recant the study and to write a document saying that it wasn't true, it wasn't accurate, there wasn't slavery in Sudan, et cetera. And he kept refusing to do this, so they kept
How
him in
widespread
jail.
Is the problem? And is it black Sudanese who are mainly the target?
Well, we were beginning to get some idea of how widespread the practice was. As I mentioned, during the late 80s, when the Sudanese human rights campaigners began to look at this issue and discuss it and try to track down stories and document individual cases they were documenting them by the hundreds, it became impossible to continue that after the current government took power in 1989. First of all, one of the authors of the study was in jail for 22 months, and that was sort of a deterrent. And talk about a chilling effect on anybody who wants to do any more research on slavery. There you have it. The publisher of the English-language newspaper who was carrying these stories went into exile. He's now in London publishing a newspaper there for the Sudanese community. So it's very difficult to tell how widespread. It's easily in the thousands. I don't know. It wouldn't be possible to say now without a more open climate in Khartoum, how widespread it is, because there isn't, as I said, there are no independent human rights organizations. There's no real freedom of the press or anything else there. You wanted to know about the victims. Are they
right.
black? Well, historically, they have been black southern tribes of Sudan. That have been the victims of slave raiding and trading in slaves by people coming from the north, either Sudanese or in the 19th century, there was a big push for slaves from the Turco-Egyptian Empire that went into Sudan specifically to take slaves to serve as soldiers in its army in the 19th century. The Egyptian Turco-Egyptian army depended heavily on slaves.
So it's a tradition that is long-standing in that area.
Well, unfortunately, unfortunately, the slavery practices go back, to 600 or earlier.
Even before that, right. In Mauritania, it's often described as the Arabs, the Berbers, and whatnot against the indigenous blacks or the Africans. And the Sudan, is it that kind of racial distinction, or is it more cultural or shall we say, ethnic?
Well, Sudan is a very interesting country in very complex racially, ethnically, religiously, and so forth, quite a much greater diversity than we have in the United States. And it's Southerners perceive it, many of them perceive it as Arab. But as I said, there are many people in the Arab northern community that are speaking out against, or when there was free speech, were speaking out against the practice.
What about Mauritania? Have you spoken about Mauritania this morning?
I haven't visited Mauritania, so I'm sorry.
Do you have much information on the situation in Mauritania, or do you know that it can be definitely said that Mauritania practices the chattel slavery as the charges have been made?
Well, I do know that we had a couple of reports on slavery in Mauritania, but since I didn't do the research, I wouldn't want to get into it.
Jamira, if people want to get a copy of your report, where can they call?
In New York, they can call area code 212-972-8400.
One more time.
212-972-8400.
And is Human Rights Watch or Amnesty International, other groups, are you planning more reports, more investigation of this?
Yes. And let me add that this is an issue in England as well. The Anti-Slavery International has been working on slavery worldwide for quite some time. And it became a big issue in England before it became an issue here in the United States within the last 2 years.
Well, we look forward to seeing more research on this and, of course, more activism. Jamira Roan, thanks for joining us. Counsel at Human Rights Watch visited the Sudan last year, came out with a report on children in the Sudan. And we want to thank Salim Wakil, in Chicago. You're listening to Democracy Now! Up next, a discussion, a speech on the prison industrial complex. And you're listening to Democracy Now! I am Amy Goodman. Crime and prisons. Yes, it's an election year, and so these are the issues we hear most of all. Well, we're going to hear from a different perspective now. Eddie Ellis is a former Black Panther who was recently released after serving 23 years in the New York State prison system. While incarcerated, Ellis was part of a prisoner-organized think tank that produced a report showing that three-quarters of those incarcerated in the state came from just seven New York City neighborhoods, all of them poor, all of them communities of color. Ellis is the founder of the Community Justice Institute based in Harlem, which lobbies for non-traditional approaches to rehabilitation, including a prisoner-run model penitentiary. This is a speech he gave this past weekend at Medgar Evers College, part of the City University of New York system, calling for, among other things, a prison-building moratorium in the United States. Eddie Ellis.
As a group of men who formerly were incarcerated in many prisons throughout the state of New York, most of whom did big, big sentences, were violent felony offenders, including myself, most of whom were educated in the prison system, and who made a commitment while we were in prison that once we got out of prison, we would try to do something to assist our brothers and sisters who were still in prison to come out, but even more importantly, begin to try to make some fundamental changes in the society out here so that many of our younger brothers and sisters will not have to ultimately go in. In the course of our analysis, it occurred to us that the problem was much greater than what we initially anticipated. And what we have here essentially is a serious assault and attack on poor people all over America, and people of color in particular, Latinos and people of African descent. And depending on where you line up in the spectrum, sometimes you can see this war and sometimes you can't. And the serious problem for most of us is that we don't even know that we're in a war. And because we don't know that we're in a war, we're losing the battle very rapidly. Some people take the position, and I think I stand with them, that from the point that Europe invaded Africa, we've been at war. Sometimes it's a hot war, sometimes it's a cold war, sometimes it's more overt than others. But at least since then, we've been in a war. Our organization has an analysis, and we say that we've simply moved from the pyramids to the plantation, to the projects, to the prisons. That has been the sojourn of African people, from the pyramids to the plantation, to the projects, to the prisons. And we're in a condition in which there is a major assault in every single area of life that affects us in some positive way. The climate in America, indeed in many Western nations, has turned right. Fascists now rule in the name of democracy. A police state is imminent. Respected members of the so-called independent judiciary are coerced to make decisions that fundamentally go against the Constitution of the United States, as if that document somehow or other miraculously conferred some special rights on people of color. And we're at a serious crisis. For those of you who do not believe that we're in a war, then you have to listen closely to the media rhetoric. And you have to understand a few fundamental things, very clearly definitional kinds of things. And the first thing is that whenever we hear the term crime or criminal, that essentially refers to people who look like us. Criminal is synonymous with being poor and being African and being Latino in America. So every time you hear somebody get up and say they're going to get tough on crime and criminals, they're talking about getting tough on you and I. They're talking about getting tough on us. And every time you hear somebody say that they want to lock up, they want to throw away the key, they want to have harsher sentences and all the litany of things that go on in the criminal justice area, they're talking about containment for people who otherwise have very little meaningful role in the economy of this country. And this is what we're up against. We're talking about cutbacks in every social service area. Let me just, as a show of hands, see how many people here work for an agency that provides social services in the community. Let me see a show of hands. How many people here are students? Let me see a show of hands. How many people here are workers in any municipal area? We're talking about everybody here. And there's a war going on against community-based organizations, against students, against social service providers, against health service providers, against housing service providers, against drug treatment service providers. Whatever area you're involved in, I would be willing to bet my life that your organization has suffered within the last 2 years. And yet, your organization is there and our organization is over here, and there's no meaningful links between us. Because if I'm in housing services, it doesn't occur to me that criminal justice impacts on my area. And if I'm in health services, it hasn't yet dawned on me that health services and housing are intimately connected. And that health services and housing are connected to political power, and political power moves the criminal justice system, and prisons somehow or other have become the linchpin of it all. So I'm going to make a few simple suggestions, and I hope that this may be the beginning of a move forward that will gather steam and impetus as we begin to organize people around the state of New York. And the proposal is very simple. In order to facilitate the criminal justice policies that are being waged in this country from the local to the state to the federal level, there has been a change in all of the laws. There has been proposals and legislation that changes the laws as it governs criminal justice. We look at what's going on in New York City. The mayor of the city of New York has declared war on the so-called quality of life type crime. I'm not really sure what that means or what that is, but I know the ultimate effect of it is that young Black and Latino men and women are now being arrested for things that normally they would not have been arrested for. Young Black and Latino men and women who used to get what they call in legal terminology a desk appearance ticket, which means the violation was a minor violation, and now being forced to go into the court system. We know for a fact that young truants, juveniles, are being picked up by the police, in some cases fingerprinted and photographed, and then being released to truant officers and others. We know that the police department has been picking up young men, school age, and putting them in lineups without authorization from their parents. It's a war going on. This is not accidental. This is not coincidental. This doesn't just happen in a vacuum. We know that the governor of the state of New York has legislation pending right now in which he will make 13-year-old children adult offenders, or he will allow the courts to treat 13-year-old children as adult offenders. There's no other area in life in which we teach 13-year-olds as adults. They can't drive, can't vote, can't buy liquor, can't do any of the things that come with adulthood. But when it comes to criminal behavior, that criminal is that African kid who at 13 years old will be treated as an adult. The governor has further proposals that will allow 16-year-old children to be removed from the juvenile detention facilities and placed in adult detention facilities, ostensibly so he could make more room for the 13-year-olds. And if we're not very careful, we will rapidly approach a time in which all of our young people are in some kind of custody, some kind of control of the criminal justice system. Right now, over one-third of all the black men in New York State between the ages of 20 and 29, one out of three, either in prison, on parole, or on probation. And there are a whole series of other, on the state and federal level, legislation that's proposed to take place that will enhance that process. And this prison industrial complex is about creating an industry in which a huge number of people suffer, poor people, African-American, Latino, Asian, so that jobs can be created in rural upstate areas that otherwise would be economically depressed zones. And for most of us, we sit back and we're really not aware of some of the things that we may be able to do in order to stem that tide. And I say all this by way of background. Our organization is in the process of initiating, or has initiated in conjunction with several other organizations, a call for a moratorium on prison construction. And we're asking everyone in this audience to join us in calling for a moratorium on prison construction, a halt to prison construction for the next 5 years. Right now, today, there is a bill pending in the state legislature in which the governor is asking for $470 million to build three maximum security prisons between now and the year 2000. And he's asking for another $400 or $500 million to open up 43,000 additional cell spaces because he anticipates that they will need those many cells between now and the year 2000. Based on the proposals for criminal justice change and changes in the juvenile justice law, to 13 years old, olders as adults, 16-year-olds moving into enhanced penalties, he anticipates that within the next 4 years, they will need close to 10,000 cells to accommodate the new group of people coming in. And we don't have to ask what those people are going to look like, and we don't have to ask where they're coming from. What we need to do is we need to begin to stop the process. The governor suggests that $900 million, that's $100 million short of $1 billion, $900 million should be set aside, is being set aside now for the construction of these additional prison spaces. We say that if we can implement and make stick a moratorium on prison construction, then we can free up that $900 million. And we say that every organization, that we need to create an alternative budget for $900 million. And that $900 million should be reallocated to every community-based organization that has lost its funding or had a reduction in its funding over the last 2 years. We say that on the basis of that self-interest, whether you're in housing or health care or child welfare or homeless care, whether you're in substance abuse, whether you're in hospitals, whether you work for AT&T and going to be one of that 14,000 that's getting ready to be laid off, this issue impacts on you. We believe that the linchpin of social policy in America is built upon the construction and the maintenance and the development of this prison industrial complex. And if we do not bring it to a halt, or in the best case scenario, slow it down, we've got a serious, serious problem on our hands. This is what we intend to do. Frederick Douglass used to say that Power can seize nothing without a demand. And Marcus Garvey said that the world history is never kind to weak people. And part of the reason that we're in this quandary, part of the reason that we're in this problem, part of the reason that we're even here today at Medgar Evers talking about this issue has to do with our weakness, has to do with our disunity, has to do with the fact that although we're all warriors in a battle, we don't have a strategic plan. We say that if we can do this, we can begin to formulate the beginnings of another movement, a movement that may have as profound and deep ramifications as the human rights movement of the 60s and the anti-war movement of the 70s. We're in the beginnings right now, we think, of the development of a movement that will have major implications socially, politically, economically, educationally, recreationally, religiously, a movement that must, at this time, begin its forward assault on those forces that are assaulting us. We say that we will begin this movement, and we are in the process of beginning this movement from this day forward. A halt in prison construction means that there will be less cells available to put our people in those prisons. And so there must be a reevaluation of who goes to prison and who stays in prison so that this scarce resource of prison cells can be utilized in a more productive and a more effective manner. We don't for a minute pretend that we don't have a serious crime problem in our communities. And we don't pretend for a minute that there are not several, if not hundreds, if not thousands of people who actually, in fact, should be in prison because they constitute a serious threat to you and I. But at the same time, we recognize the fact that those prisons need to be places in which productive things happen so that people don't go into prison and come out worse off when they come out than when they went in. We say that if we have a moratorium on prison construction and we limit the number of cells available, then we can go to a policy of one out, one in. That if every time you put one in, you bring one out. We believe that there are thousands of people in the prison system in New York and perhaps all over the country who don't need to be in prison. The first category is men who've already served their time, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years or more, and who the parole people and other authorities refuse to release. And I tell you why they don't want to release these brothers, because these are the strongest, toughest, most glorious warriors that you've ever seen. And if they ever come out here in any wholesale numbers, that is to say, those who've used their time productively in prison, if they ever come out here in any serious numbers, we begin to see the kind of changes that need to take place in our communities that we have not seen before.
Eddie Ellis, a former Black Panther, recently released from the New York State prison system after serving 23 years. He is founder of the Community Justice Center in Harlem, New York. It's number 212-735. His number is 212-427-4545. That's 212-427-4545. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin with help from Pat Greenfield. It was engineered by Matthew Finch at WBAI, directed by Errol Maitland. Production help from Janice K. Bryant, Bernard White, and Dred Scott Keyes. For a copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is a production of Pacifica Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.